Welcome to Ask Peggy About Your Finances, because prosperity is so much more than money. Brought to you by writer, speaker, and certified financial planner, Peggy Doviak.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask Peggy About Your Finances show. My name is Peggy Doviak, and I am a certified financial planner practitioner. This is a show for you. It's a show to help you understand the stock market, to keep up with legislative updates in issues that involve your money, to learn about new financial planning terms that you might not really understand, and then finally, in the last section, to ask me questions in the Ask Peggy part of the show. You can send these questions to my Ask Peggy Facebook page, or it might be easier to go to peggydoviak.com, that's peggydoviak.com, and you can send questions there. There's a place right on the home screen where you can submit questions that I can help answer for you. So let's get started with the bulls and bears market and economic update. So today is October 1st, which means that we have begun the fourth quarter of the year today, and we have the financial and market data in for the first three quarters of the year. And no doubt, the market really picked up in the third quarter. I think this was partly a function of the market becoming more and more convinced that really nothing dire and dread was going to happen via the tariffs and the trade wars. Now, the China issue is still on the table, but even just news breaking this morning is we've reached an agreement with Canada. So now, even though theoretically NAFTA has apparently been replaced, there's a replacement in there for Mexico and Canada. The news report I heard this morning said it's like NAFTA on steroids. So as long as we don't have tariffs in place, as long as we don't have trade restrictions, this market probably has more room to run. So if we look at the numbers, the Dow went up a little over 9% in the third quarter. Now, for the year, it's up a little over 7%. So what we see is up until the third quarter, the Dow was actually down, and then it made up so much territory in the third quarter that it's actually up for the year. So year to date, we're up 7, but in the third quarter, we're up 9. The S&P 500 was up a little bit before the beginning of the third quarter because it went up 7.2% in the third quarter, but it's up almost 9% for the year. The NASDAQ has been the indicator that's just been ignoring everything. It was up 7.14% in the third quarter, up 16.5% for the year. Gold was down the third quarter, and it's down about 10% for the year. Oil is up 25.78% for the year. So oil has had a huge run. Now, those are all of the indicators that I usually give you. I want to provide one more indicator this time as we're looking at quarterly data, so we're taking a little bit longer view of things than we usually do, and that is to talk about the AGG, which is an index fund that tracks the aggregate bond index. So basically, this is a kitchen sink full of different kinds of bonds, and how has it done for the year? Well, the third quarter, it went down about 0.75%. Year to date, it's down right at 3.5%. So what that suggests is that the rate of decrease is slowing as the market is becoming more and more convinced that it knows where the bond market is going to go from here. And actually, there was an announcement of an interest rate increase last week that did not send the bond market crashing again. The yield of this fund is 2.86%. So it's actually this year been a cash flow negative item. So why would anybody own it? Because it has very different risk-return characteristics than stocks. And so the things that make bonds go up in value are not the same things that make stocks go up in value. I understand when there's a negative return in something that the indication might be, oh, wow, I need to sell it. But it's actually, you've got to be very careful that you don't mess up your diversification strategy. Now, I'm not telling you to buy this fund. This is absolutely not a recommendation for it. But what I am saying is sometimes you've got to be careful as you put together your portfolio. I've talked about this during this section of the show before, where you don't let your excitement about making money in technology or oil get ahead of you and cause you to really change your investment strategy. You know, you can look at things to the edges, but you really want to be careful. I think that the way the data is moving in the bond market right now, I really still think we're not going to get a big crash as they continue to raise rates. I sure could be wrong. I don't know. I know that sometimes when I think I know what the market's going to do, it surprises me. But I do think that possibly the worst is behind us in the bond market, and that it's very important not to mess up your risk tolerance profile by chasing something that's going up really fast.
Thank you to Voices of Oklahoma, KVOY 104.5 FM, for the opportunity to share my ideas. Thank you also to Sports Talk 1400 in Norman for production and studio assistance.
Welcome back to the legislative update portion of the Ask Peggy About Your Finances show. If you were listening last week, you heard me talk about the lawsuit that's been issued against the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, for failing to implement the debt relief from for-profit institutions bill that was passed under President Obama's administration. So what that law said was that when a student had enrolled in a for-profit educational institution that ended up basically being a scam or simply mismanaged everything and went defunct and left students either with no degree at all or a degree from a university that didn't exist anymore, that they could get student loan relief for the money that they borrowed to obtain that degree. And remember, the problem is Secretary DeVos has not been actually implementing the rule. And so now there was the decision that she was going to, they were going to study it, but that what she was doing was wrong. So to help magnify the scope of that, the Attorney General from the state of New York, Barbara D. Underwood, has led a coalition of 16 other attorneys general that have issued a statement opposing Secretary DeVos's not implementing the rules that were already passed. According to Attorney General Underwood, online education provides many benefits, but it also carries risks for students and challenges for regulators. So the concern is that as we've sort of entered a free-for-all in higher education, that the students need some sort of relief from the money that they've borrowed. Because remember, the other problem with these for-profit institutions is they're most of the time much more expensive than going to a traditional university not-for-profit. So, you know, it could be a private college, it could be a public college, but the tuition costs, especially of the in-state public colleges, are typically much lower than these online for-profit institutions. People enroll in them because it's easy and it's convenient and you don't have to go to class and you complete everything online and you pay a really steep premium for that ability. Well, if then the institution goes under, either while you're trying to get your degree or afterwards, and you're left with a degree that's not worth anything, you may have taken out enormous student debt to pay for it. And so this rule was supposed to provide that relief. And the attorneys general, not only of New York, but the list of states is Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Iowa, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Minnesota, North Carolina, Oregon, Rhode Island, Virginia, Washington, and the District of Columbia. All of the attorneys general from these states has said this is wrong. They've signed a letter saying that it's wrong. And so, you know, what sort of weight does it carry? Not necessarily as much, but I have to wonder if there couldn't eventually be state-level prosecutions and issues with this. I don't know, but it's certainly moving in the direction of more and more states saying, this is absolutely not fair to our students, and so we need to do something to help keep them safe. So that's the first issue of the week. The second issue of the week involves another piece of legislation that I've been talking about, but when people finally read the fine print, there's a little bit of a catch to it. It is the Bipartisan Retirement Enhancement and Savings Act, RESA. It's been pretty popular on both sides of the aisle. I think it's more popular with Republicans, but the idea of increasing consumer savings has been appealing really to all people. But there is a weird component of it that I just want you to be aware of. I'm not sure I think it's a bad deal. I just think you need to know about it. So it used to be, prior to this piece of legislation, that if you inherit an IRA, you're allowed to stretch the distribution over your lifetime. Quite frankly, this is how most people who inherit IRAs handle it. You take the account balance as of December 31st of the year before, and then there's a divisor, and every year you take a little piece of the IRA until it's distributed. It works exactly like required minimum distributions, except the divisor is a little bit different for reasons that are probably way too complicated to want to talk about here. Suffice it to say that the money's distributed a little bit faster when you inherit it than it is when it's your own retirement money. This feature is called stretching an IRA, and it's been very popular because it's a good way to allow money to grow income tax-free. And then you take a little bit of it at a time, you manage to divvy out that tax liability, and it, you know, everybody wins except the IRS. And so within this RESA legislation, there is a piece that says that, yes, you can stretch your IRA, but not for the amount over $450,000. So for the first $450,000, and I'm assuming they'd keep the same divisor table, but you take the little piece at a time. For the amount over $450,000, it has to be distributed within 5 years. Where do they get the five-year number from? The five-year number is what happens when people don't set up IRA beneficiaries correctly in the first place, or if it, the beneficiary to your IRA is not a human being but an institution. So the distribute in 5 years is already an established component of some parts of IRA distribution. So really what RESA is saying is, okay, the first $450,000, you know, almost $500,000, you can go ahead and stretch it. But for anything over that, then you have to take the distribution within 5 years. We'll see. This rule, according to what I'm reading this week, this tax package 2.0 may pass. I'm not sure. I still have serious doubts. You know, if you've had a 401k and it's worth more than $450,000, and for some people that's absolutely the case, the reason this matters to you is you can, if you've inherited it, you might want to divide it out so that you take less of a tax hit. If you're trying to take $100,000, say, and you've got 5 years, to mess up your taxes the least, it would make sense to fill however far you are into the bracket each year and then look to see what the next bracket would be to see whether or not how much you'd really want to take. Let me give you an example. These are completely made up numbers, so don't look them up in the tax code. They won't be there. But let's say that you're in the 12% tax bracket, which that's the new one under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. It's the second bracket up. It goes 10, 12, then 22. You want to look at where your income is. If you could finish filling the 12% bracket and do that for five successive years, it would be much better than taking the entire distribution and, you know, getting up to the 22 or even higher than that bracket if you could make the math work. Because just because the person you inherited money from had money, that doesn't necessarily mean you as the beneficiary have money. So I always want you to look at distributions as a combination of how much do you need, where do they hit within the tax tables? So always take distributions, the minimum you have to take, but then if you need to take more, start looking at tax brackets and filling those lower brackets so you don't get yourself in a mess that might have been avoided if you'd done a little bit better tax planning first. As with everything, as this rule moves through the legislative process, we'll keep up with it. I know there's so much noise right now coming out of Washington that there's a lot of stuff that it's really hard to even find a news story on, but I'll keep digging through the information and I'll try to help you stay up to date.
Thank you to Voices of Oklahoma, KVOY 104.5 FM, for the opportunity to share my ideas. Thank you also to Sports Talk 1400 in Norman for production and studio assistance.
Welcome back to the Plan Your Prosperity segment of the Ask Peggy About Your Finances show. My name is Peggy Doviak, and in this section, we look at different financial planning topics. And today, what I want to talk about is when to take Social Security, because that's one of the biggest questions that I get from people. They're thinking about retiring. Maybe they're trying to decide whether they should retire at 62 or full retirement age or 70, and they're trying to figure out their cash flow needs. So it's really important to talk to your certified financial planner practitioner about when the best time to take Social Security benefits for you is, but there's some information here that can help you make that decision. So if you decide to take your Social Security benefit at age 62, you're going to get about 75% of your full retirement age benefit. So whatever you're going to get at 65 or 66, remember that your full retirement age is actually kind of a moving target. And it absolutely depends on your birthday, because it's not like your full retirement age actually is 65 or 66 or 67. There can be months in the middle of it. So maybe it's 66 and 3 months. So pay really close attention to that so that you actually know when your full retirement age is. That will mess up your benefits if you don't get that piece of it right. But your age 62 benefits are about 75% of that. If you should wait until you're 70 to take your benefit, it's about 132% of your full retirement age benefit. And people ask me all the time, you know, shouldn't I take Social Security as quickly as I can? Because what's going to happen to Social Security? We hear it's underfunded. We hear there's issues. Yes, it's underfunded. Yes, there's issues. Now, this is just my belief, but this is my show, so I get to tell you my belief. My belief is I don't believe that there's any congressional group, House and Senators, in any particular year who all want to wholesale be fired from their jobs. They also don't want to deal with millions of people over the age of 65 coming to Washington, D.C. and storming the Capitol, because there's nothing worse than an angry senior citizen. So do I think Social Security is going away? I don't. Yes, we have funding issues, but you know, we have funding issues on stuff all the time. What we do is we increase the funding. And it looks like the big push of limiting the social programs may be going away when Paul Ryan doesn't run for re-election come January. And I'm not picking on Paul Ryan, but he's had a long-term goal, he says, since college, of revamping the Social Security system. Well, he didn't get it done. We're less than a month or right at a month from the midterms. He's not going to get it done. And I really don't see people having an appetite for this. I absolutely believe that Social Security will exist in some format. The easiest way to fix Social Security is to get rid of the taxed income cap. Right now, and I didn't look this number up to the dollar, but roughly the first $120,000 that you earn is subject to Social Security. after that, the money's not subject to Social Security. So what it ends up being is those of us in lower economic class, middle class, upper middle, depending on where you live, $120,000 can actually be a really good salary in some locations in the country. We're bearing all of it, and everything over $120,000 is not subject to Social Security tax. If you got rid of the cap and you taxed all earned income, I think it would fix it. If it didn't totally fix it, it would go way down the road in fixing it. So I think they're going to fix it. I just don't think they want to right now. So don't let your fear of the benefit going away completely drive and saying, oh, I need to take it when I'm 62 because it's going to go away. Really, I think realistically, it's probably not going to. So then it comes down to cash flow. So we always think, well, should I take it at 62 or full retirement age or 70? Remember, you have an option that is any month in the middle of that period. So it's not like there's only three times you can take your Social Security benefit. You can take it at any point. You just can't take it before you're age 62. So maybe it makes sense to take it at 64. Your Social Security benefit increases approximately 8% for every year you defer taking it. That's not a cost of living adjustment. That's actually the base benefit amount goes up 8%. If you don't take it at 62 and 63, it goes up 8. If you don't take it at 63 and you take it at 64, it goes up another 8%. And it builds all the way up then to age 70. At age 70, you have to take it whether you need the money or not, whether you want it or not. So some of when you take Social Security depends on how much you need that benefit to grow by. Remember, too, that if you want to take it early, you are limited in the amount of money that you can earn. For years prior to age 62, I'm sorry, let me try that again. Yeah, if you take your benefit at 62 and then you work more money than you're allowed to, you lose one benefit of every $2. So $1 of benefit for every two until age your full retirement age. During the year in which you reach your full retirement age, you lose $1 in benefit for every three. So if you're thinking about taking the benefit early, it's important to look to see how much you're planning to work. Because we're going to try and get this out a little bit more clearly. You lose $1 out of every $2 of benefit from age 62 to full retirement age if you earn too much money. And then the year you reach full retirement age, you lose $1 for three. That causes a lot of pain for people. They don't think about it. And a lot of people say, oh, well, I'll just take it at 62, then I'll work. And they don't realize there's that cap. The cap changes regularly. So always check with your tax professional to make sure you know what your income cap is for that year. If you wait and you don't take the benefit until later, there's the assumption you're going to live longer. So if you have a lot of longevity in your family, it might make sense to wait and take the benefit later. If you're not anticipating a long lifespan, there's a happy thought, then you might take it earlier. But I'll remind you that looking at your parents and your grandparents isn't a great rule of thumb because we've had so many advances in medicine since when those people typically died in our life. The things that used to kill you just don't. So if you've had good medical care and good nutrition and lived in a safe environment, your longevity is likely to be pretty high. So don't assume you're going to die young and take the benefit early because of that, because you really might pay for it later. So take all those ideas into consideration. Talk to a certified financial planner professional and don't just randomly choose a date.
Thank you to Voices of Oklahoma, KVOY 104.5 FM, for the opportunity to share my ideas. Thank you also to Sports Talk 1400 in Norman for production and studio assistance.
Welcome back to the Ask Peggy segment of the Ask Peggy About Your Finances show. My name is Peggy Doviak, and this is the segment of the show where you can ask me questions. The easiest way to do that is to go to my website, peggydoviak.com, and submit the question, and then I'll try to answer it on the air. Now, I actually took today's question from a different source. And I was looking at an article that was written about the YouGov surveys that people complete. YouGov is a survey site where they question people about all different kinds of issues. So there's political questions and sports questions and popular culture questions and personal finance questions. And so in this survey, they gave people financial planning terms, really basic personal finance terms, and asked them how confident they were that they knew the definition of it. Now, you should note that they didn't actually ask the person the definition. See, sometimes people are really confident that they know something, and then they really don't. But in this particular case, all they did was ask people how confident they felt. And then they compiled a list of common words, and there's a big report on it. It's a really interesting study. But I want to talk about one of the terms that people weren't sure they understood, and that word is liquidity. And liquidity, 63% of the population said they thought they knew what it meant, but 37% of the population said they didn't. And I think liquidity is a very important word to understand because it's the basis of so much financial planning. Basically, an investment or an asset or an item is liquid if it is easily and quickly turned into cash with little or no loss of value. So for something to be liquid, it's got to be easy to turn into cash, and when you turn it into cash, you can't lose a lot of money. So if it's hard to sell, it's not liquid, and if you could suffer a loss on it, it's not liquid. The reason this matters so much in personal finance is your emergency fund needs to be liquid. Remember, your emergency fund is supposed to eventually be 6 to 9 months of your salary expenses laid back into an account so you could pay the bills if you needed to. So you do your cash flow analysis, you figure out what you spend, and that much money then times 6 or 9 goes into an account. Remember, too, that I suggest that you start with a much smaller number than 6, and you start out saving like a 2-week emergency fund. The problem is sometimes people want to invest their emergency fund in the stock market. And the problem with the stock market is it isn't liquid. It is easy to sell generally if you purchase something that's publicly traded, but there could be a loss of value on the day you needed the money. So if you've got money in an investment account, the problem with that investment account being your emergency fund is there's a very good chance that the day you needed it because you had an emergency, the market was also down, and it could force you to sell your assets at a loss. So your best bet for an emergency fund is something really boring, like a bank account, just in cash. Or you could do short-term laddered CDs. Now, the problem with CDs is they're not necessarily liquid. So it would need to be CDs that could actually be cashed in early without a loss of principal. But your emergency fund needs to be liquid. It needs to be something that probably is cash or is really easy to turn into cash. So if you need the money, you have access to it. Have a great week, and I will see you next time.
Thank you to Voices of Oklahoma, KVOY 104.5 FM, for the opportunity to share my ideas. Thank you also to Sports Talk 1400 in Norman for production and studio assistance.
You may submit personal finance questions to the Ask Peggy Facebook page and learn more at PeggyDoviak.com. And remember, prosperity is so much more than money.